Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Early December, but not much of politics at the moment, although we will see. So tonight, thanks to Catherine Brisbane from Currency House for drawing our Anne and my attention to this book, Who Profits from the Arts? Taking the Measure of Culture. So today we've got Kay Ferris here and David Adair. Do I pronounce that Ferris? Ferris, as in an I. Okay. So I'll introduce them both briefly. We're going to start off with Professor Ferris talking, and then Dr. Adair is going to join in the discussion period. So Professor Kay Ferris is a widely published researcher in the fields of cultural participation, aesthetics, creativity and cultural history. She's currently leading Sustaining Culture, an Australian Research Council funded research collaboration involving Griffith University and its industry partners, the Queensland Performing Arts Centre, the Adelaide Festival Centre, the Sydney Opera House and the Arts Centre in Melbourne. And she's been Dean of the Faculty of Arts at Griffith University since 2003. Dr. David Adair is a researcher who publishes in the fields of cultural citizenship, aesthetics and cultural participation. And since 2005, he's been a research fellow in Griffith University Centre for the Public Culture and Ideas, where he works as a researcher and the project manager of Sustaining Culture. So Professor Ferris is going to kick off, and then we'll have questions discussion, and David Adair is going to contribute. Professor Ferris, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. Can I also thank Catherine Brisbane, our publisher, and the Copyright Agency Cultural Fund and the Keir Foundation, who've made our visit to the Sydney Institute possible. So thank you to all of those. The measurement of economic and social impacts of the arts and culture is a complex undertaking. The sector has no clear, commonly agreed boundaries, and it encompasses diverse activities, many of which do not follow an industrial logic. Employment data also presents problems, as involvement is typically underreported. Not all arts practitioners work in cultural organisations, while others are engaged in primary employment, their day job, outside the sector. The economic, social and cultural benefits that flow from the sector to the broader community are similarly difficult to pin down. Internationally and within Australia, attention has increasingly focused on the arts' contribution to enhanced quality of life and living standards. Urban planners and regional economists have begun to see arts and culture as part of an ecosystem of creativity and innovation. The arts' intrinsic values may elude measurement, but considerable energy and ingenuity has been invested in establishing their links to economic innovation, urban regeneration, inward investment strategies, tourism and trade, and social cohesion. The arts operate across the public, non-profit and commercial sectors, each of which has its own operating principles and values. For public policymakers and corporate sponsors, arts managers, artists and audiences alike, participation in the arts means crossing these fault lines. Many artists and audiences find festivals, small venues and arts companies easier to access than the larger venues and flagship companies. Lower overheads mean they are generally cheaper to attend, while proximity to ever-changing street cultures makes them more nimble and quicker on their feet often than the larger companies. They offer fewer and less formidable barriers to young audiences in particular. By contrast, the larger venues are major public assets that cost more to operate. They are also designed to embody values of civic pride and prestige. Like the more established companies, these large venues tend to have a greater reach than the small arts organisations. They have bigger audiences and stronger and more extensive contacts, both inside and outside the arts and culture sector. These larger organisations often host artists and companies and typically take responsibility for building the artistic, financial and administrative capacities of smaller companies as ways to contribute to industrial development in the sector. In order for artists, technicians and administrators to have careers in the arts, they must navigate through this differentiated sector. Audiences make their own journeys through its public spaces and the physical and virtual retail spaces that give them opportunities to consume arts products. The design and building of pathways facilitating all of this traffic are important matters for public and private organisations to consider. In 21st century Australia, as elsewhere, cultural institutions and precincts are centrepieces of urban renewal. These projects recognise the importance of culture and the arts in creating vibrant public spaces and productive flows of people and ideas. Melbourne's Federation Square is now the home of the Museum of the Moving Image and the extension of the National Gallery of Victoria. The laneways of the Melbourne CBD are widely recognised as contributing to the cultural life of the city. Their cafes, specialty shops and cluttered ambience now loom large in Melburnians' sense of their city and are promoted as cultural micro-hubs and tourist destinations in their own right, as you'd be aware from the Lose Yourself in the Arts of Melbourne campaign. Some of these laneways function as informal art galleries, cultural capillaries coursing with street art. The Victorian era and early 20th century spaces of the city are now being rediscovered, reconfigured and revalued. Other Australian cities are also investing in a vitalising mix of cultural spaces, even if not all of these initiatives enjoy Melbourne's high profile or long history of public and private support. The Adelaide Festival Centre surrounds have been rebuilt to improve access from the cultural precinct along North Terrace, where the Museum, State Library, Art Gallery of South Australia and University of Adelaide are all located. In Brisbane, the popular South Bank precinct combines commercial, residential, cultural and recreational uses. The Queensland Performing Arts Centre, Museum, Art Gallery, the recently rebuilt State Library, the new Gallery of Modern Art and Griffiths Queensland Conservatorium now anchor one end of a cultural precinct that extends along the Brisbane River to the Queensland College of Art and the new Griffith Film School. This is the national context for Sydney's recent interest in cultural planning issues. In May 2006, the Danish firm Gehl Architects was asked to prepare a public spaces and public life report for the City of Sydney. The first stage of this study of Sydney's inner urban built environment and its impacts on quality of life was an audit of the CBD. In September, the principal of the firm, Jan Gehl, wrote in the Sydney Morning Herald that when visitors venture beyond the impressive facade of the Circular Quay district, they find a CBD that is more Kansas than Oz. Sydney's CBD, wrote Gehl, is merely utilitarian. It attracts people for work and shopping, but offers few reasons to linger for the pleasure of being in the city. In fact, Gehl identified numerous disincentives for people to experience the city by day and night. Traffic lights that prioritise motor vehicle flow and access, a lack of public spaces, including pedestrian laneways with places to visit and things to do, an alienation of the city's streets from the harbour that produces a feeling that one might as well be in Kansas City, and footpaths which limit access for the elderly, the infirm and the very young. A civilised city, Gell wrote, lets vulnerable people feel safe. In the language of cultural economics and urban planning, the Sydney CBD is falling short of being a sticky place. This term describes the city's magnetism and dynamism, its urban core stability and cultural vitality. Culture has a civic importance because it provides spaces where we can meet friends, colleagues and strangers alike, discuss things not otherwise broached in the home or the workplace, and be sociable. A vital urban culture needs a healthy mix of small and large spaces, both formal and informal, where a variety of encounters can take place. Some firms and workers, particularly those characterised by high levels of human capital, law firms, for example, are particularly attracted by the right combination of costs, amenities and networking opportunities. Increasing global competitiveness means that a city's social and economic well-being can depend on public policymakers and the private sector getting the mix right. In Sydney's case, the recent government and media interest in the problem suggests a growing public anxiety about the city's claims to global city status. From Brisbane, we have watched with interest as the traditional Sydney-Melbourne rivalry has taken a somewhat unexpected turn. This intercity competition seemed to have settled down somewhat after Sydney eclipsed Melbourne as the nation's financial capital and staged a successful Olympics. Now these very achievements are being seen as working against Sydney successfully reinventing itself in an age when the economic value of amenity is widely recognised and culture's social role is being reconsidered. Factors like affordable real estate prices, an ability to provide amenities to skilled and highly mobile workforces, and policies that encourage cultural organisations to develop effective partnerships are now the measures of a city's cultural vitality. If Sydney is failing to measure up, how will it respond? In July 2007, Sydney's Town Hall was the venue for a Creative Futures debate on this problem. Some of the responses aired at that meeting included introducing tax breaks for professional artists and more public financial support for large cultural and arts institutions to help them lead a cultural tourism recovery. Over the following days, the debate continued in the pages of the Sydney Press. Since then, reform of Sydney's plasma and pokies, club and pub culture, and in particular, the issue of liquor licence reform, has joined public transport as a public priority area that must be addressed if Sydney is to become a more livable and globally competitive city. Small cafes and cultural micro hubs don't always need a liquor licence to open or even survive. They may, however, require one if they are to thrive and proliferate. For the small hole-in-the-wall venue, the musician who performs there, the artist who designs a poster or flyer or website for the musician or the cafe, the young fashion designer who gets a toehold in the market by opening a tiny shop next door, success or failure can turn on a glass of wine. Rationalising the licensing laws is a legitimate response to the problem of how to ensure a city's cultural sustainability and vitality, but it is only one part of the bigger picture. There are other factors with a part to play. Most economic studies of culture and the arts gauge their value in one of two ways, either as a percentage of GDP or through the calculation of multiplier effects. The former method involves adding together the amounts patrons pay for items like tickets to performances, transport, meals and shopping in the cultural precincts where large cultural and arts organisations are typically located. Aggregating these amounts then gives the total dollar worth of cultural and artistic activities in a region. Unfortunately, this method can't account for opportunity costs. the things you might otherwise have bought with that money, or the benefits forgone when public money is spent on cultural responses to, for example, the problems of mental health, rather than spending on a local health centre. Calculating the total worth of the arts industry can also founder on the harsh realities of statistical data, or at least on the reality that statistics are commonly assumed to be uniquely capable of capturing and conveying value. Multipliers are the second and more sophisticated method used to measure the economic value of cultural and arts spending. They calculate the financial flow-on effects of culture and arts expenditure on related activities and employment. Arts advocates now routinely factor these flow-ons into their rationales for private and public sector support, despite their inherent problems. Like total worth, flow-on methods don't address opportunity costs and likewise strain under a burden of proof. The economic and social benefits of arts participation, their instrumentalist values, are hard to identify and measure. There may be long time delays between attending a concert or a play and deriving a noticeable social benefit, such as better intercultural understanding or an increased capacity for empathy or a change in your views about a particular social issue. It's similarly difficult to trace higher levels of employment in, for example, the tourism industry back to a cafe manager's decision to start giving gigs to musicians. There is a gap between measurement and value here that statistics cannot fill. Established approaches to understanding and measuring the contributions of the arts to growth and development are increasingly questioned by some regional economists who challenge their emphasis on exports at the expense of local production and consumption, their focus on the arts industry rather than on occupations, and a tendency to confirm culture as a sort of optional infrastructure above the level at which real economic value is created. One of this new breed of economists, Anne Marcusen, argues that the economic value of the arts is not adequately captured by export-focused studies, since most artists initially produce for local consumption. Only in a handful of the world's largest cities do the arts attract significant income from outside their region. Whereas traditional economic impact studies focus on the major organisations of the arts industry and the impact of events associated with them, Marcusen focuses on the occupation and the individual artist. This approach recognises that as well as artists using their capacities to export their products beyond their region and thereby add to its income directly, they also contribute value to the region's pool of human capital in a variety of ways. They might teach, they might share their talents through involvement in a community arts organisation, they stimulate local supply chains by producing and consuming goods themselves, and they improve products and working environments for local firms and organisations. Focusing on occupations also has the virtue of acknowledging that, with the possible exception of those who work in the performing arts, artists have high rates of self-employment and may therefore fail to fully register in organisational studies. Even in the performing arts, the relative importance of occupations and skill sets is changing. As work becomes more contractualised and outsourced, and as cultural activities are less tied to the clock and the factory model, people and their talents are increasingly crossing between all types of arts activities and other sectors. Very typically, artists find that crossing over those sectors provides them with very different kinds of rewards. In the community arts centres, for example, and community organisations, they can engage with local issues and local networks. In not-for-profit organisations, they can often push their practice a little bit further than they do in the commercial sector. So working across those sectors provides them with both benefits in terms of money, but also benefits in terms of enhancing their practice and their relationships with their local community. Technicians who light the stages in a large performing arts centre might also work in a film studio or at a dance party. Actors who work in the theatre also appear in television advertisements. Computer programmers who set up data management systems can find employment for theatre companies, computer gaming, and other creative industries. Occupations are therefore becoming the logical focus for efforts to understand and increase the cultural value of our cities. In fact, one of the indicators cultural geographers use to measure the stickiness of cities is the willingness of certain groups of workers, artists and other information professionals to live and work in the urban core. Richard Florida has become one of the most recognisable names among international researchers, arguing for the importance of amenity in attracting and retaining a talented workforce to a city or region. And Florida's been very active in Australia in the past, particularly in Adelaide. His main point is that an ability to create what he calls, to attract what he calls the creative class rather than firms, is now what determines a city's ability to compete economically. So his work looked very much at the IT worker as an example of that creative, a member of that creative class. People who were footloose, able to work globally, and whose talents needed to be attracted magnetically to cities. So Florida's work is very much about industry development and the role that the amenity provided by arts and culture can play in attracting these, what he calls creative workers. He really means IT workers, not necessarily artists. And Florida is famous for his Bohemian Index and other instruments that he uses to measure that amenity and stickiness. This demographic, the creative class, Florida argues, is attracted to a location because of its quality of life, including its cultural amenities. And the index that signifies that that kind of amenity exists is, there are a variety of them, but his Bohemian Index, he measures things like the number of artists and creative workers who exist already in a city. He looks at things like the gay index as a measure of that bohemian quality in particular cities. And he's made a lot of money, I might say, from providing advice to cities like Memphis and many cities in the European Union about this. Marcusen and her colleagues used the incidence of self-identified artists in a region as revealed in US census data as their main proxy for the artistic dividend. This allows them to adopt a definition of artist that captures the range of cultural work taking place across a variety of art forms and in the commercial, non-profit and community sectors. By comparing these occupational data across metropolitan regions and between specific regions and the US economy as a whole, they are able to measure the relative size of the artistic dividend, even if that measurement errs on the side of caution, partly because part-time artists who derive most of their other income from other occupations aren't counted usually as artists in the census. And the work that Marcusen has done, if you're a web surfer in Minneapolis, St. Paul, to using GPS systems to actually show where these concentrations of artists and where the stickiness of the city is most apparent, is a very interesting thing to look at, and I think a very interesting way of representing just how that value is manifested in the urban landscape. In addition to census data on artists, the artistic dividend indicators include the number, kinds and size of organisations, venues and support services available to artists in a region. Comparing these data makes it possible to identify the factors that confer relative advantage on particular regions. Many of these factors are alterable through a combination of public policy initiatives and private sector efforts, and can be guided and assessed by measurements of the available indicators over time. This kind of quantitative data, I have to say, isn't really available in Australia to the extent that it is in the States. Perhaps an Australia card would have made a difference to the kind of data we can collect, but we don't have. The ABS is only just beginning to collect this kind of data in Australia. While quantitative data can help represent the artistic dividend, for a fuller picture, we have to look to qualitative research techniques. This is why Marcusen and others conduct qualitative interviews with artists to better understand how they conceive of their own work and its economic returns, the strategies they use to build careers, and the extent to which they market their creative skills and works of art to businesses, target markets, and the general public. It's now broadly accepted in Australia and internationally that the arts sector is in urgent need of more qualitative research to better understand its audiences and its public role. Statistics on attendance habits or the popularity of particular art forms do not capture the quality of audience members' experiences. Statistical data do not provide adequate bases for identifying the value of the arts. Of course, statistics do have legitimate uses. Figures on how many artists live in an area, the number of cultural and arts policies integrated into the broader public policy field, levels of public and private funding, how many children play a musical instrument, all of these can be used to measure a locality's cultural vitality. These data, nevertheless, only give a partial picture of the health of a functioning cultural system. We need more than figures on the costs of providing a good or service to understand its public value. Another problem of making a fetish out of data relates to the sheer quantity of the stuff. There is no data drought in the arts and cultural sectors at the level of reporting back to funders against performance indicators. In fact, arts organisations can easily drown in that kind of data. This is why they need a more comprehensive way of representing the arts dividend, one that combines indicators of inputs and outputs, data and knowledge, quantitative and qualitative research techniques. In our partnership with the Performing Arts Centres that Gerard named at the beginning, a partnership which has now extended to Perth and Auckland, we have been undertaking research which addresses a lot of questions that have up till now gone unanswered, both in Australia and internationally. The kinds of questions that we're asking and gathering beginning to gather empirical data about are questions like this. What kind of culture do citizens value? How do they assess what is a cultural activity? How does this activity fit within the everyday life of communities? To what extent is cultural capital linked with the social capital of the community? And what role does this play in its economic and social development? Our response to those questions has been sketched out in the platform paper. I hope that you'll read it. And thank you.
I'm going to ask David Adair a question. Just tell us what you're on about at Sustaining Culture, just what you're doing there. And just talk to the back of the room and you'll be preserved forever in the Sydney papers. And then then we go to the normal question discussion period. So just tell us what you're on
about. I have there's a very brief way of describing what we're on about. Oscar Wilde was right. A cynic knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. Now, there's a gap, and this is particularly true in relation to the arts, where there is a huge gap between measurement and value. In the past, cultural consumption was often understood in relation to social hierarchies, social stratification. What we've been particularly interested in the project is in social networks, the social networks within which people are making their decisions about cultural consumption. And we've gone about that in various ways.
Thank you.
Short.
So, I think if you both just stay around here, we'll go to questions and discussion. I should initially just say thanks to CAUSE for the use of this fine facility this evening. It's a great facility. And Anne's got some copies of Who Profits from the Arts, which is you can purchase it at the end of the proceedings. So we come to questions and discussion. So question here and then we go there. Yeah. Who does profit from the arts? Now let's, I think we should come back here and talk. Yeah.
What we're trying to establish that is that it's possibly not just the people who actually consume them. That's one of our concerns, to look to see how that profit is more broadly shared, even by people who might not see themselves as arts lovers, who might not go to the opera house. And in talking, we've talked to a lot of people who do use the various arts centres that we're working with. And the kinds of things we've asked them about are how they bring how their participation enhances friendships, for example, how it enhances family, particularly intergenerational relationships. And what we've found is that lots of people want to be more involved in communities, and they're beginning to think about how their arts participation might help them to do that. But just to go to Jared's question about how we're doing this, we're using a model of public value that's been developed by an American researcher called Mark Moore from Harvard, and he talks about the authorising environment, the environment that legitimates any kind of activity. So that means artists and companies, it means government and arts bureaucrats, it means politicians, it means the people who actually go, but also the wider general public, who may never step into the opera house, but who nevertheless are glad that it's there. Yeah.
So there's a question there and then behind. Yes?
You might mention the two books by Florida, because they are rather good. I suppose you quoted these two books.
The Rise of the Creative Class and The Flight of the Creative Class.
Very good indeed. Yes. My question is, I'm a retired science professor, and as you know, in science and technology, the different universities have established centers of excellence and cooperative centers. Now, considering the problems you mentioned, which need to be researched, do you people in the humanities or in the arts have something similar as a center of excellence or a cooperative center to be able to holistically integrate all the different disciplines to solve your problems?
The closest thing I think would be the Humanities Research Centre at the ANU, which is much broader actually than Creative Arts. There's also on the model, there's not a Centre of Excellence or a CRC. There should be. There is a Centre of Excellence at QUT that's connected to a variety of other institutions. It's very much focused on a particular aspect of, it's called the CRC in Interactive Design, and it's very much about technology, things like handheld devices and how they can be a new space, if you like, for creative content.
But there's something missing, really, in
Yes, I think you're right about that. Yeah. Well,
hang on, we can't.
How about proposals for the
There's a hole in our holistic consciousness. Fix it.
I would say one of the things we'd like to do when we report on this project is look toward an application, and we'd need to get some fairly powerful partners to create something that you see in a number of countries now, in the UK, in Europe, there's a particularly good one in Canada, called a cultural observatory. And you can look at the Canadian one if you type cultural observatory in Canada into Google. It brings a lot of this sort of material together. Canadian government hosts the site. I'm not sure what universities in total that it's associated with.
Can I raise a question about, you're talking about cities and you made some comments about Sydney, but I guess one of the problems for the artistic community in Sydney is that it's pretty expensive to live here.
Yes.
So in other words, the bigger the city, the more vibrant the city is financially. Probably the fewer artists are going to live here because garrets are cheaper in Melbourne than they are in Sydney. So how would you realistically overcome that? But before you do, let's get back behind here and talk to
in the, yeah. Well, in the States, which of course has a different system, a lot of cities are returning the various kinds of taxes that they collect from hotels to the arts community to establish cheap residential accommodation in particular areas. And in fact, the Brisbane City Council has done something like that in the Valley. It's produced, it's done some zoning that enables some space, public spaces for arts incubators, but it's also linked to accommodation. But the Valley is also getting very expensive, and I'm not confident that that's an arrangement that will continue.
Okay, there's a question here. Let me go down the back. Yeah, here? Yeah.
It's a question about, I think it's called the Bill Bauer effect. Do you support that idea that you go in and buy a big building by a well-known architect and that then provides the focus for us for a city?
I know that's been a very fashionable thing elsewhere, and it's in Europe, it's even creeping into universities. I was at the Freie University in Berlin, and they've had Norman Foster come in and build a library for them that's like a brain. You walk into it and it's like being inside someone's head. It's the most amazing, wonderful building. And in Brisbane, we've just had GOMA appear, which looks, as someone from Sydney said, like a big beach house, and it does. It's got, as against all the other arts buildings we've got, which have got very concrete, hard walls, this one's all glass. I think money could be spent better. You know, it's nice to have, well, the Opera House, who would want to take that away? But I'm not sure that every city can support, you know, can flower just because, and Bill Bauer's an example, you know, it's a great place to visit for a couple of days, is my opinion.
Yeah. I just want to add something to that. One of the issues is the a building isn't enough. It's about making a building permeable, both physically and in other ways. QPAC in Brisbane has a master plan at the moment, and if they can get the money from the government to carry it out, they will be actually physically piercing the building and opening it out to the river. At the moment, it's not very user friendly in that way. So, and of course, you've had issues with the Opera House as well. All of Australia's performing arts centres are showing their age. They're all products, if you think about it, they're all products of the 50s and 60s and built in the 70s and 80s. So building isn't enough. It's the kind of building you have and how it's integrated beyond and into the city.
Hello,
Nanette. Yes, actually, that is one of the crucial questions to maintaining content is that's important here. My question is really a political one, and it's a question been asked in mind about whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. If you can come up with some measures, will they make any difference? Because in the arts, you keep trying to escape from the syndrome of having the crisis we're about to shut down. We call it being. You don't know what it's got to be gone after the crisis. So are you optimistic that it's got to be able to make a difference in what's going on?
There is no magic solution. There is no one language. It's about different kinds of vocabularies, different kinds of lexicons that you're using, because you're describing a variety of different sorts of values and benefits. So there isn't one way in which you can actually turn all that into, money or enlightenment or whatever. If that answers your question, I'm sorry.
You want to answer that?
I might just add, although it doesn't, it does appeal to policymakers. And apart from this project, we've just been involved with the Cultural Ministers Council, who have a statistics working group, who are looking at the international efforts to produce cultural indicators. And although it'll take a couple of years, it's clear that we're going down that path. And in being involved in that, what we've tried to do is to tend them toward indicators that might measure, might determine what are vital signs of a cultural environment, and measure against those. So, yes, economic indicators, but a variety of others as well.
Down the back, yeah.
I think I've got a couple of things from David Dare's last comment. First question, how will your work assist in making a case, for example, that we could be spending some hundreds of millions of dollars to fix up the interior of the Sydney Opera House? And secondly, looking at the future of our major performing arts centres, you picked on Queensland and said, if they can get government money to do what they want to do, then they will do this. The history of performing arts centres in Australia is they are moving from being reactive places where people hire their halls to being proactive supporters and promoters of the arts. We have a long-term pattern, for example, taking the 60-70 orchestras in Australia where they move from control of the ABC to independence. Do you see the possibility of major performing arts centres moving out of the government trust model and moving into a more sort of Kennedy Centre, South Bank, London style model of being independent entities competing out there for everybody's money to do what they want to do?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. All of the performing arts centres have a dual role. They are venues for hire, and they, as you pointed out, they're increasingly acting as producers. And they are expected to do that. They all operate under charters. They're all set up to provide comprehensive services, excellence to the people of their states. And to some extent, they're constrained by those charters. As for the Sydney Opera House, the Sydney Opera House, again, is different. You know, the Sydney Opera House is, to a large extent, a tourist destination, and a place like QPAC, for instance, relies a lot on musicals. In Brisbane, we've had a long tradition of musicals, so which you don't tend to find in the Sydney Opera House. I'm not sure I can...
That's fine. Do you want to answer that?
I mean, I was just going to say that the kinds... Moving to that model, we also need to be aware that in most cities elsewhere, with the exception of places like New York, those kinds of facilities don't have the sort of density of population to really support hugely profitable commercial activity. And that's one of the points that Anne Markhuizen makes in her study of various cities, contrasting places like San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York with places like, the more medium cities like Minneapolis, St. Paul. I think that's the real issue in moving away from government funding, being dependent on government funding for those very large buildings, is that, you know, the population density and the demand side probably wouldn't sustain that kind of commercial activity.
I've got a question here, I've got one there. Yeah?
For me, some of the great cities of the world characterise wonderful gardens, really great gardens. You think of Paris, you think of Florence, you think of Salzburg, all sorts of places. The garden is like a tourist attraction, but it's a great place where the ordinary human being can preserve their mental health by getting away from the flat or the neighbours and the little suburban street. And I find what's happening in New South Wales, that Frank Sartor will sell every bit of land that we've got, which might be a garden, and put a block of flats on it. And not only that, we've got a lovely area called Cullen Park, which was a part of an old psychiatric hospital. We won't put any mental patients in there. The garden would be very good for their mental health. He wants to put in 5,000 university students.
That's a great effort, Hilary. I must congratulate you on getting Kellen Park into a question on arts funding. I think that's an artistic endeavour. Well done.
I did say that the boundaries of the cultural sector are fairly flexible, and certainly gardens are cultural things, spaces. And I agree with you. There are not many places for solitude in the city anymore either, especially when you think about not just gardens and, you know, particularly those little pockety ones that you can just retreat into. But church doors are shut a lot now too. And, I mean, when you think about many of those cities that you mentioned, the other... what we were trying to talk about in terms of cultural institutions anchoring some of this, you know, centuries ago, churches, cathedrals anchored that kind of laneway, little activities, all sorts of stuff going on. And they still do in places like Taipei, where, you know, outside the temple, there's all kinds of activity happening in little booths. I agree with you.
But there they, without being unfair to Taipei, I mean, they shoot arsonists, don't they? That's the trouble, isn't it? I mean, you know, churches are worried about arsonists.
Oh, yes.
Cathedral or Catholic Church of Parramatta was burnt down an arson attack.
It's a good question.
Yeah. The mere fact that people talk so comfortably about the Bilbao effect is surely just a marketing failure by the Sydney Opera House, which had the same effect 25 years earlier. So to what extent are your researches going to assist, because you didn't really answer the question from the gentleman earlier, assist the argument for $600 million to make the opera theatre actually into a workable artistic space? It's not actually going to improve the tourism, but it may make the opera going experience for the elite better.
And it's interesting, when we talk in various contexts to arts bureaucrats, if you want to get them instantly thinking that they don't want to talk to you, say the word opera. It's amazing. I mean, David mentioned the problem of social stratification, and I have to say, you know, cultural activity is an economic activity. You buy a ticket, you know, you're spending quite a lot of money. You can spend quite a lot of money going to football too, but if you're spending money going to arts events, you're often spending quite a lot of money. And one of the conclusions ways we've tended to think has been very much influenced by a researcher in the States who looks at music called Richard Peterson. And he has simply tested out a very influential academic way of thinking about culture. I'm sure you're all familiar with the term cultural capital. It's a term that really was popularised in academic writing by a Frenchman, Pierre Bourdieu. And his interest was in how people used capital, cultural capital and other kinds of capital, but cultural capital in particular, to move up social strata. And of course he was looking at France, which was a particular kind of society. Richard Peterson took those ideas and then looked at the data in the States to see whether in fact that was borne out by what you could see happening there. And he coined a term, the cultural omnivore. the univore is the person who uses a cultural practice or activity to create a bounded identity connecting to a group. What in social capital talk is called bonding social capital. Omnivores use culture to go everywhere, to cross over lots of different groups, and to build the kinds of weak ties that produce not little tribes, but larger common groups of people. So we really think that there is a problem with the association of culture still in the kind of common way of thinking about it, and certainly in bureaucratic thinking, with the idea of strata, you know, elites. And as I said, the real test of that is seeing how people react to the word opera. And yet, it's a popular form in very many places. In Brisbane, it's a very popular form in a place called Park Road, Milton, where there's a very well-frequented Italian coffee shop that has a big screen that plays all the World Cup soccer, football, but which all the rest of the time plays opera. And, you know, everybody's there. It's not a particularly elite taste. If it
sorry,
can be...
I'm sorry I used the word elite. It's allowed you to go into a marvellous academic sideline. You haven't actually answered the question, but how sustaining cultures is going to make a case for...
Well, I guess what I was wanting to say to you was... What it's told us is that this is probably more than sustaining culture can achieve, actually. We might be able to help a bit. But, yeah, don't hold your hopes too high.
Anyone's got a spare $600 million,
that's...
he's your man. So we're going to conclude pretty soon. So who have I missed? No, you had a question. Final question there. Yep.
I was just wondering, it's more of a question from Florida, but when his argument seems to be that the more artistic the city, the more the creative class will bottle the comes. But I was just wondering, have you even come across the idea, though, that really doesn't presume the idea that all art is good for a city? Have you ever come across the idea that, say, I don't know, there might be bad art, there might either repel people or not? I'm thinking particularly about, say, hip hop in the States, and a lot of conservative groups, you know, criticise perhaps, encourage crime perhaps, or even thinking about, say, Greenwich Village, which is a very creative atmosphere in the 70s in New York. I mean, that was pretty drug fueled and whatnot.
Yeah, and that's, I have to say, you've hit on something that most projects about the arts like to skirt around, and that is that it costs a lot and not all of its effects are good. You certainly can't argue that. I mean, the other interesting thing about the States is that 40% of the people who work in music in the States actually work for churches. So that's an interesting thing to think
about.
Just
a final question. What's the aim of your paper? I mean, who's this aimed at? What impact do you expect, would you like it to have?
Well, you may be aware that the platform papers have a format which allows people to write a response. And I think there are some responders in this audience who might like to go home, read the paper and write their response to be included in the next issue. We really are trying to exploit that format and see if we can stir up a little bit of discussion about some of these issues. So I said it at the Brisbane launch. If you read the book, think about the next step and bombard Catherine with lots of responses.
The deadline is in the books.
The deadline's here. So the copies of Who Profits from the Arts over there. Look, many thanks to Kay Ferris and David Adair for a very interesting discussion tonight. I mean, I learned a lot from it, and it's an important pamphlet or paper, and there is a readers' forum down the back, and have a go. But for tonight, many thanks for coming along, and thanks also to Catherine Brisbane. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.